All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. This is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969. Welcome to our program. I'm really excited today. We've got two Vietnam veterans guests. I just left the message for my friend who can't get on Zoom, so he's going to be calling the station, I hope, pretty soon. And we will go from there. But Doug Bradley is going to be on the program. And Doug, as you know, is one of our favorite people. He writes all about the music of the Vietnam era. He was in Vietnam. He wrote, We Got to Get Out of This Place, and He'll Stop the Rain. He's got another book that's coming up shortly. So he's going to be on whenever he gets through, hopefully. And then coming up after a quick break, we've got Frank Fox coming on. And Frank has written a really cool book called Jersey Boy Takes Flight. And all of you who have been listening to Veterans Radio over the years know that I am from New Jersey as well. And this book was a time trip for me. He grew up pretty close to where I grew up, and many of his adventures were similar to the ones that I had, at least when I was a kid. And he went to Vietnam also as a pilot. And so it's a great story. It's fun. I think you'll enjoy the interview with Frank. He's kind of a character. I really enjoyed talking with him, and I'm looking forward to talking to him again. The other thing, while we're getting, we may just go into that interview if Doug doesn't come along. But now every week, I want to make sure that we thank our sponsors, because we can't do this program without them. And they've been with us for some of them for 20 years. And we really appreciate that. So let me tell you who we did. So we got Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans is specializes in veterans disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. Remember, if you are a certified veteran-owned business, you can do business with the government. They give out special contracts to veteran-owned businesses, so make sure that you get certified. And these are the folks that can help you do that. PuroClean, the paramedics of property damage. PuroClean is one of the nation's leading restoration franchise networks and is made up of entrepreneurs just like you. And veterans get 25% off the franchise fee. Pretty cool. So for more information, go to puroclean.com. One more. Charles S. Kettles, VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. The Irwin Prescott American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to support Veterans Radio, which I hope that you will, please go to our website, veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. Thank you in advance for your support. And now to our program. So joining me on the line is our good friend, Doug Bradley. And Doug is...
Dale, your microphone is muted.
It changed. Hold on. How's that? Okay, so gremlins all over the world today. Whoa. It's changed back. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, folks. We're very professional here today, and we're moving right along. Anyway, so Doug Bradley is, as I mentioned before, has written a number of books about the music of the Vietnam era. He was our speaker last year at our radio on the River fundraiser. This year, he's been invited back to Southeast Michigan to be the guest speaker at the Fisher House Michigan's Songs of Service. So, Doug, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Dale, it is always a pleasure. It's great to be with you and your listeners. You know, great hello. And to my fellow vets listening in, welcome home.
Welcome home to everybody. So I was really excited when I found out that you were going to be the guest speaker this year at the Fisher House.
Well, I'm pretty excited myself. I hope that excitement parlays into you're getting a ticket because this is, Dale, I mean, you guys know this. You talk about this all the time. You have people on the show. This is one of the best nonprofits we have because what they do is the Fisher Houses, and there are about 100 of them across the country and around the world, is improve the quality of life for military, active military vets, service members, retirees, veterans, families, and caregivers. They save lives. That's the bottom line, is that the organization does that. You are fortunate enough to have two in Michigan, one in Ann Arbor, one in Detroit, and I'm fortunate enough to be invited out on their gala this year, their fourth annual fundraiser, and it's about songs of service. And, you know, hey, you know, you got me, you're going to have songs. So I'm really excited about it, and I do hope anybody listening that's within traveling distance of Detroit can come on April 5th and support this wonderful organization.
It is truly a great organization, and we've been fortunate enough, as you know, to be behind the fundraising before we even got to Fisher House here in Ann Arbor. And then they were able to raise enough funds to build one in Detroit. And so that's kind of what they're going to be celebrating at Songs of Service on Saturday, April 5th. It's kind of cool. It's going to start at 4:30 in the afternoon. It's in downtown Detroit at the Book Tower, which is one of those refurbished office buildings in downtown Detroit, so it's going to be really kind of cool, I think. And I'm excited to go. I do have a ticket. I have to admit that we placed a little advertisement in their brochure for the event, so I will definitely be there, Doug. I'll be happy to see you again.
Oh, Dale, that's great. I mean, and you guys, I mean, you're through your efforts and the broadcast are supporting, you know, us vets every week. And yeah, I mean, this is a critical time, given, you know, the challenges that the national VA is facing, a lot of commotion and turmoil about, you know, benefits and staffing. Fisher Houses are probably even more vitally important because they're right there next to the VA hospital and medical facilities. And if there's a family emergency, I mean, they even provide, people donate their miles on airlines to help families get there, to be by the side of the veteran or the military member, their family. So, yeah, tickets are still available. I know that, www.fisherhousemichigan, it's all one word, and it's an F-I-S-H-E-R, fisherhousemichigan.org/events. We'd love to fill the room, not just because you and I are going to be there, but because of organizations
doing. Yeah, we're not the main attractions here. The main attraction is Fisher House itself, and it's such a great organization. Again, for our audiences that aren't quite familiar with what a Fisher House is, it's sort of like a Ronald McDonald House, and when a veteran has to travel a great distance to utilize the facilities at a VA hospital, the family can stay at the Fisher House absolutely free instead of having to stay in a hotel or motel, wherever they are. And it's really cool. It's like a really cool B&B type of place. You know, they have a huge kitchen, a commercial kitchen where people come and, you know, they can cook meals if they want to. All kinds of nonprofit organizations out there will come in and cook meals and donate food. And it's a great facility. And, you know, the interesting thing that kind of cool is that once the Fisher House is built and all ready to go, Fisher House National turns the keys over to the local VA. And so, you know, as you mentioned, with some of the turmoil out there, we got to make sure that people are aware that this Fisher House is going to keep going. And I'm sure
Absolutely.
That it will.
No, well said, Dale. In fact, you're a better advertisement than I am because you've known this, you've seen it. You know, I spend part of my time in Wisconsin and part in Arizona, and the Fisher House activity is not as vibrant. We only have one in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. I know we're trying to get one in Madison. And like you said, it's a vital function. It's important. It's essential. There's nothing more important than having family close by to the service member or the veteran. So that's what they're all about. And, you know, again, you've heard me show multiple times, and you've seen me in person. You know, I like to talk and tell the stories about the song. So the folks there have told me I got to keep this to 20 or 30 minutes. So I'll try and pack in as much good music and good reflections from veterans as I can. But again, yeah, the real important thing, the nexus of all this is the Fisher House activity, the organization, the nonprofit. So, yeah, if folks have a chance, you know, get there and do what you can to support Fisher House, Michigan.
Absolutely. It's going to be a fun time. I know I worked as a DJ for Doug last year at our fundraiser. So we're going to be hearing lots of great music for those of you out there that are familiar with 60s music. This guy is literally a walking encyclopedia on that. So I encourage people, those of you in Southeast Michigan or can make it out, to come out to the Songs of Service, Fisher House, Michigan, Saturday, April 5th at the Book Tower. And as Doug was kind enough to point out, just go to fisherhousemichigan.org/events. Tickets are available. Come on down. You get to meet two of your famous people in the world, right? Doug, thank you.
Dale,
thank you so much for being here.
Always. And thank you. It'll be great to see you again. Welcome home to my vets, fellow vets who are listening. And, yeah, come out if you can, folks. We'd love to see you on April 5th.
Okay. We will. I'll see you then. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you much.
All right. See
Bye-bye.
You. All right. We're going to take a quick break here, but it's going to be an introduction to my next guest. So for those of you that have listened to Veterans Radio over the years, one of our favorite guests was Joe Galloway. And unfortunately, Joe has passed away, but we saved his voice. And so we're going to play a little thing that is taken from a documentary called In the Shadow of the Blade. And so here we go. So this will be it. And we come back, Frank Fox, talk on helicopters. Here we go.
Here today who doesn't thrill to the sound of those blades. That familiar wop 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 is the soundtrack of our war, the lullaby of our younger days. To someone who spent his time in Nam with the grunts, I've got to tell you that noise was always great comfort. It meant someone was coming to help. Someone was coming to get our wounded. Someone was coming to bring us water and ammo. Someone was coming to take our dead brothers home. And eventually, someone was coming to give us a ride out of hell. Even today, when I hear it, I stop, catch my breath, and think back to those days. I love you guys as only an infantryman can. No matter how bad things were, if we called, you came. Down through the green tracers and other visible signs of a real bad day, off to a real bad start. To us, you seemed beyond brave and fearless, that you would come to us in the middle of battle, in those flimsy, thin-skinned crates, and in the storm of fire, you would sit up there behind that thin plexiglass, seeming so patient and so calm and so vulnerable, waiting for the offloading and the unloading. We thought you were God's own lunatics, and we loved you, still do. We're the fortunate ones. We survived when so many better men gave up their precious lives for us. We owe them a sacred debt to live each day to its fullest. What they're saying when you listen hard enough is this: we're at peace, and so should you be, and so should you be.
And we are are back here on Veterans Radio, and that was Joe Galloway, taken from the documentary In the Shadow of the Blade. I don't know if I necessarily like being called a lunatic, but it's better than some of the other things I've been called. Joining me on the line right now is my new good friend, Frank Fox. And Frank is the author of the book entitled Jersey Boy Takes Flight. It's the story of one man's life, loss, and love during the Vietnam era. He is a fellow New Jerseyite. He's also a fellow Rotorhead. And I'm really happy to have Frank on the program. Frank, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, Dale, thank you very much for having me. And from one Jersey boy to another, I love your introduction with Joe Galloway, period.
He was a great writer, and he really did love his veteran community. I think he was the only civilian to receive a Bronze Star for valor for the Battle of Ai Trang Valley many years ago now. So the book, what made you decide that you were going to write this story?
Well, Dale, I started this story 35 years ago. And I had a series of, you know, stories and vignettes banging around in my head, and I wanted to leave a footprint. I tell my grandchildren I essentially was doing this term paper for them. And that's essentially how it all turned out. But as I got into it, I started seeing how I could link a lot of my life's events together, you might say. And I started liking the way the story sounded. In life, some of the things that seem somewhat innocuous. If it had 50 years or so to look and sort of reflect on the entirety of our lives, it's like some of those things that seemed insignificant were the most significant things that happened to us. And so when I looked at it that way, and maybe if I had started this project 10 years after coming back from Vietnam, I wouldn't have had the same reference points. So, like I said, I started liking it, and I started being able to see how I wanted to tell the story. I also wanted to share stories where I had some good experiences in life, met some good people, had some good people as high school teachers, some mentors, friends of my father, and things like that, that I wanted to remember them in a way. And I think you've read the book, so you know that I have probably cited 6 or 8 people and in remembrance, but it's not a formal remembrance. It's they became parts of my life, and I enrolled them, you might say, into it. One interesting story is my high school. Our high school, the superintendent of our high school was Monsignor Thomas Reardon. He walked amongst us every day as high school kids, and we just didn't know what a national treasure he was. He was the first Marine Corps chaplain ashore at Guadalcanal, and he stayed on the beach for 85 days.
And you know, I don't mean to interrupt you here, but you know, I was thinking about this when you mentioned this in the book. You know, how many of our teachers from our whole generation, just, you know, those of us now that are in our 70s probably, you know, if we look back at the teachers that we had in high school, how many of them were World War II veterans, and how many of them had really stories to tell? And if we'd only had the hindsight to, you know, go back in time and say, hey, Mr. Fox, tell me about this adventure that you had. Because you grew up in New Jersey, talk a little bit about growing up in the 50s and 60s in New Jersey for our audience. Not everybody's familiar with that.
Yeah, I think New Jersey gets looked down upon, it seems, an awful lot. But my remembrances of New Jersey are the Jersey Shore. And I think you have roots there also.
Absolutely.
Uh, There's 170 miles of beautiful beach. I don't want to sound like a member of the Chamber of Commerce, but I've been all over the world. And I still remember the beaches at New Jersey as being some of the finest that I've ever been to. And, and also had an awful lot of fun there. But growing up in New Jersey, having been born in 1947, the 50s were, somewhat tranquil, for an 11, you know, 10, 11, 12 year old kid. And, these were the days when, on any, you might say summer vacation day, your mother would tell you on the way out the door at 9 o'clock, remember to be home for dinner at 6 o'clock, which means that us young guys, you know, all kids, had the entire day to do things like ride our bikes, go swimming. If the season was correct, go ice skating, slide over the dam spillway into the river, pitch baseball cards. I'm sure you remember that.
I think I lost a lot of cards doing that.
I don't think I ever won at that game. And it's the reason why I never gambled as an older guy, because I figured the die was already cast. But, we used to flip cards too. You could pitch them against the wall or you could flip them. But, those were really good times. Very fun. An awful lot of good memories. And you're right about, I think when I look back at friends of my parents, teachers, Boy Scout leaders, Little League coaches, all of those men were Second World War veterans. And they all were very can-do people. And, you know, a lot of that rubbed off, even though you don't know it's rubbing off. And and you hearken back to those guys. And, I think in my instance, they were mentoring me and I didn't know it. And so that was a good thing. I think a lot of that's going on nowadays also. But when you're right up and close, you don't notice it until you reflect upon it some years later.
Right. Yeah. We don't see those things until then. So how did you end up getting into the Army?
Well, so the 50s turned into the tumultuous 60s of, you know, assassinations of U.S. presidents. A senator running for president, Martin Luther King, race riots, civil rights riots, anti-war, anti-draft protests. And so as a young guy at that time, which now starts becoming I'm becoming of military age, and we have a looming war that's an ever-emerging war, if you will, getting bigger and bigger, a lot of commitments being made by our country. It was probably very prominent, the most prominent thing on one young man's mind at the time. I decided at the prime of my draft years to, not go to night college and instead take a chance and play Russian roulette with the draft, thinking that the government would never catch up with me in 53 days. Well, they caught up with me in 53 days, and I was drafted on the 1st of August, 1966, and I was drafted into the Army. I didn't have any regrets. I was shocked that they could be that efficient, and the way things turned out for me as a 19-year-old, now that I've looked back over the years, and I did this long before we got to this point, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, was having served in the military. As a case in point, I got drafted, and a lot of people I knew didn't want to be drafted and didn't like it, and they took it as a bad thing, if you will. I was okay with it, but then all of a sudden a few opportunities were presented to me, like being offered an opportunity to go to officer candidate school. I went.
I thought that was rather interesting that you were offered that at 19 or 20 years old to go to OCS.
So I graduated as second lieutenant of infantry. Recall you were talking about your infantry experience down at Fort Polk. Mm-hmm. So I graduated as second lieutenant of infantry, and I often thought that if I had gone immediately to an infantry platoon, I'd have been the youngest guy in the platoon as the platoon leader. I did do that for a short period, but then I later went to flight school, and that was another opportunity that was presented. The point here is that to me, sometimes in life, Weigh the pros and the cons. You know, I went to infantry OCS and then to flight school. You did too. It was a helicopter war and it was dangerous. But sometimes, you know, and when you're 21, you're bulletproof anyway. Sometimes, though, circumstances present themselves and you have to weigh the pros and the cons. You have to do that in life, no matter where you go. Don't be afraid of taking a chance. It might pay off in spades as you march through life. So that would be my advice to young people who maybe are faced with the same kind of things. I realize we don't have a draft now, but there are other things and in other walks of life on a daily basis, you're faced with those kind of decisions. Mm-hmm. I would say take a chance after you do as much research as you can and think about it.
So you ended up in flight school. Out in beautiful Fort Walters, Texas.
Beautiful Fort Walters.
Right outside our miserable Wells, Texas. And,
yep.
and I've told these stories on the air before, but I'd love to hear them again. So what aircraft did you learn to fly in?
My basic trainer was the TH-55.
The Mattel Messerschmitt.
Yes. It looked like a hard-boiled egg. Blown up about 50 times with a stick coming out the back and a very small tail rotor. But the IPs were very confident in its abilities, and because of that, so were the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and by the way, it was an aircraft that we didn't know this at the time, but when we went on to advanced training, we ended up flying UEs. Unlike some others who flew the H-13, we went right into UEs at Hunter Army Airfield. And the control touch on a TH-55, believe it or not, was somewhat similar to a UE. So the transition from one aircraft to another in terms of, control touch, et cetera, was similar.
That's interesting. So you ended up going to Fort Stewart.
I went to Hunter Army Airfield at Fort Stewart, yes.
Okay.
I think I was the third or fourth class, but they opened it up when we were there and we had an opportunity to apply to go there if we wanted to go to Savannah instead of Fort Rucker.
Oh.
I wanted to go to Savannah because I was thinking of the Jersey Shore and the beautiful beaches, and it was going to be summertime, and there were co-eds probably from Savannah University and the University of Georgia down there. And it turns out that although it was a beautiful place, it was a little bit on the old folks' home side. And so, but it was still a great place, and it was a great place to finish flight school during the summer of 68.
Yeah, I'm assuming that it must have been a little bit more fun than being in Southeast Alabama.
It was a lot more fun than Southeast Alabama.
Quick aside question is, during the second part of your flight training at Fort Hunter Stewart, did you guys fly out over the beaches or did you go inland? Or I thought that would be kind of cool.
Well, we never low leveled down the beach like all of us wanted to do, but
we waited until we got to Vietnam to do that.
We had to wait to get to Vietnam to do the fun, real fun stuff. Yes. But we did fly out over the beaches. You know, we took all of our instrument. The first 8 weeks was instrument training under the hood.
Right. Yeah.
And the way the flight patterns all seemed to work is I guess they had the beacons, at some of the shore towns, if you will, Brunswick, Georgia and places a little bit further south in Savannah. And we flew up into South Carolina too, but we were doing all beacon work, with the hood on. So you really never got to see much unless it wasn't your turn to fly and you were sitting in the back.
Right.
But we flew inland too. In fact, one of the, a rather cool event, excuse me a second. A rather interesting event we had was that you're familiar with Fort Benning, Georgia, the home of the U.S.
Yes,
infantry.
Yeah.
Not too far away from Savannah. It's just across the state. One of the exercises we had was to go down to Fort Benning and pick up officer candidates who were being trained as infantry officer candidates to be commissioned to second lieutenant and to do a combat assault with our UEs, picking up the soon to be lieutenants and then flying an actual combat assault to some other end of Fort Benning. We did that once, but that started to become a part of the training for both sides.
Yeah, we did that. We came from Fort Rucker and did the same thing.
Okay, so there you go. So we did that. It was interesting. So when I reflect back on that, I often think that, you know, those guys that were there, the, I don't know, 180 of them that we airlifted that day, I wonder how many of us crossed paths in Vietnam and did the exact same thing, but now as bona fide Army aviators and second lieutenants or perhaps first or captains, infantry officers in Vietnam doing it for real.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if you could research that.
I can tell you this. A quick story is that I ran into when I was leaving Vietnam and was derosing out at the 90th replacement. I was in the bar there, and lo and behold, there was my company commander from basic training. And he was coming back for his second tour, and he was a big redheaded guy. And I walked up to him and I said, you know, Captain Siebert. And I said, you know, and he looked at me and he just goes, "You lived.
You made it."
You made it. I said, "Yes, I did. Yes, I did." So, but yeah, you never know where you're going to run into these these people that you experience. I mean, considering all of those that you met. So when you were in Vietnam, what was the mission that you had over there?
Well, I was in the 192nd Assault Helicopter Company, and we were a lift company. We conducted combat assault missions virtually every day. And then we also flew for want of a better word, the ash and trash missions, you know, right. Like, you know, fly people out to such and such a place, go pick up people coming in to be returned home, pick up the mail, pick up the, you know, the sea rations, whatever.
Early Uber.
Yes, and early Uber is right. The unit that we supported exclusively for the entire year was 3rd to 506th, 101st Airborne Division, which we were all real proud of doing. We were not attached to that unit, but we supported them exclusively. And for us, that's the unit that was the Currahee Regiment during the Second World War, yeah. Which has been made famous by I can't remember the author's name, but he wrote the book, The Band of Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for us kind of interesting to be supporting that unit that landed in Normandy, that went all the way to Birch's Garden, and that was our mission.
Yeah, that
for the entire year.
That's an interesting. We're going to take a quick break here, Frank. So I want to so we can, you know, wet our whistles a little bit, and so we're going to be playing our Medal of Honor segment today, and then we'll be coming back with Frank Fox. The book is Jersey Boy Takes Flight, and we've gone through flight school and we're in country, and we will be back right after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Warrant Officer Frederick Ferguson led a four-ship helicopter formation into a South Vietnamese army compound under heavy fire. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
After completing a hitch on the Navy, Ferguson got his commercial pilot's license and then joined the Army to fly helicopters. 2 weeks after graduating from helicopter school, he was in Vietnam. On January 31st, 1968, Ferguson heard that a 1st Cavalry helicopter had gone down in Hue, and another had been badly shot up trying to rescue them. Ferguson and his crew agreed to go get them. While refueling, he asked 3 Huey gunships if they wanted to accompany him. They did. The GIs in the compound reported they were under heavy fire. Ferguson circled until the fire abated, then began a low-level high-speed run into the compound. He descended blindly in a dust storm from his rotors. When he touched down, he saw there was only 1 foot clearance on each side of his blades. The GIs jumped aboard and Ferguson pulled up. A mortar shell exploded under his aircraft, spinning it 180 degrees. One of the Hueys was shot down and the crew rescued. The other two were so badly shot up by the time they landed, they were no longer able to fly. Ferguson received his Medal of Honor from President Nixon on May 17, 1969. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Frank Fox, and his book is Jersey Boy Takes Flight, One Man's Story of Life, Loss, and Love During the Vietnam Era. So, Frank, we've got you in country. You're supporting 101st Airborne, I'm sure that you had some adventures while you were doing that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. One that comes to mind in particular was one of those, you alluded to it earlier, I think, in your introduction. Bad things never happened during good weather. There was always bad weather associated with it. So a particular incident that happened with me, summer of 69, I was flying or assigned to fly with a gun team, and we were on standby. I'm sure your unit did the same thing. So anyway, the standby birds got called out this night, and it was in the middle of a monsoon, horrendous thunderstorm, lightning. So six aircraft were dispatched to go up to near a place called Dalat, and a ranger team had been taken under fire there, so they needed to get out. Long story short, the rain was so horrendous, it sounded like hail hitting the front of the aircraft. Windshield wipers did no good no matter when you used them, but it didn't matter. We were flying on instruments, although not instrument that really instrument qualified. And it was tense, and the weather made it tense. I had visions in my brain of thinking, we got six or eight aircraft all going to the same spot. None of us can see the other airplane. We're all going to run into each other and just become big piles of junk. Turns out then that all of a sudden, this Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who's flying a C-47 spooky aircraft and who's probably flying up about 8,000 feet, he sees these aircraft coming through the clouds and the thunderstorm, and he radios down to us. We were in a Tiger Shark aircraft. Tiger Shark 1234, this is spooky 345, whatever. It sounded like God was addressing us. I remember looking at the co-pilot. Actually, I was the co-pilot. I was with CW2, Don Hancock. I remember Don and I shooting a quick glance at each other and saying, was that God that was speaking to us? And if it was, it sure happened at the right time. What he said to us was, I see you guys coming up. And he sorted us all out, you might say. He told us that in about 5 minutes, we ought to break out of the terrible weather. There'll be a big shaft of clear air, if you can believe it. You don't think God's not on our side?
Yeah, I know.
And in fact, it all happened that way. So over the years, I've thought about that mysterious Lieutenant Colonel flying a spooky aircraft. And I thought that he was probably 50 years old, probably a World War II veteran, probably weather beaten, probably had 20,000 hours of flight time. And he took all eight of us young 21-year-old Army aviators, herded us up, made sure we were all, in sync, got us to talking with the people on the ground, drove us into the contact area. And from there, we were able to accomplish a mission. And essentially, our lift ships rescued eight Americans that night. And it was something to see and something to be part of.
Absolutely. And you never know. Flying in the weather of Vietnam in the monsoon season was just the worst. And as you mentioned, the wipers were terrible because they'd all dried out during the dry season. And if you turned them on, you were going to wreck your windshield.
If I'm not mistaken, the windshield wiper situation was so bad that the crew chiefs used to just safety wire them up so that they'd never move.
Yeah, they wouldn't let us turn them on.
Right.
Which was fine. which was fine.
I have a follow-up story to this particular evening in Vietnam. So fast forward to 84 or 85. So that's a full 15 years forward. I was assigned to the Pentagon, and we used to all carpool. So we have there's five of us in the car. We're all Army aviators. We work in the aviation division, and we're stuck in a snowstorm on I-395 going south. So the conversation, you know, we all start just telling war stories, this, that, and the other thing. And it turns out that the fella who's on my right, up against the door, he starts talking about a place called Song Mao, and he starts talking about terrible weather, you know, holy cow, spooky aircraft, a big shaft of air, clear air for 8 miles on either side, and these Army guys who came to get us. And it turns out he was the infantry lieutenant on the ground. And he and I, in all likelihood, spoke to each other on the FM radio that night. It was like we looked at each other and just couldn't believe it. And we kept telling and retelling the story to where we made sure it matched, and it matched. His name was Ken McGinty. He later went on to become the Army's program manager for the AH-64 helicopter, the standard attack helicopter today even. And so it was Ken McGinty and I, two guys who had met 15 years earlier in a god-awful place during a god-awful storm. And here we are sitting in the comfort of the backseat of somebody's big Buick.
Oh, I had a similar experience. I can relate to that. Some guy says, were you in such and such a place? And I said, yeah, I was there on approximate dates. And he goes, I was there. And in our area down in Three Car, we had this mountain called Nui Ba Din that just kind of erupted out of the rice paddies. And he was there. And I would drop supplies off to these guys all the time. You know, you mentioned the Ashton Trask stuff. Anyway, so the subtitle of your book was Life, Loss, and Love. And we all know about the life, which is funny. People, you got to read this book. It's got some really great stuff in here just about growing up in the 50s and 60s, which no matter where you were in the country is pretty similar, I'll bet. We know about the loss of anybody who's been in Vietnam. We always, you know, how many friends that we lost there and have lost since then. I want to know a little bit about this love story.
Oh, the love story. Well, you know, I can't tell you the entire story.
I know you can't tell me the whole thing, but your wife is in the background there.
But in reflecting back on the love story, I've been happily married now for 54 years. Next in June, it'll be 55 years. To my lovely wife, Kathy. It turns out that Kathy met at a time when I was in flight school. And as a result of a terrible tragedy and incredible circumstances and coincidences, we ended up getting married, 2 years after I returned home. The rest is in the story, if you will, but the things that brought us together, I touched on it a little earlier about, you know, things that happen. You participate in something and you think nothing of it. And then all of a sudden, X number of years later, you say, you know, that thing that I was involved in and I met these people, you know, they became the most significant people in my life. You didn't know it at the time. My life has been filled with examples like that, which is part of the reason why I put this book and I put it together, you know, the way I did, was because I think some of those stories had to be told. It added something to your life story, or my life story for sure. Mm. So it's interesting how we met. It's interesting, how it turned out. It's interesting, that I met people that became significant people in my life when I thought that they were just going to be acquaintances in passing. And it turned out to be, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me. My wife and I have two children and two grandchildren. And I mean, life is good.
Life is good, as the shirt says. Yes.
Life is good.
That was a terrible. I, you know, when you got back home, from Vietnam. You stayed in the military. What was your job after you got back?
Well, after we got, can I tell the story about flying home on the Freedom Bird?
We may all
have the same story. We all had the same feelings, I'm sure, that once you got home on the flight bringing you home, there was a lot of nervous chatter on the airplane because it was a god-awful 15-hour flight or whatever. We landed up at SeaTac in Seattle. And as we got closer to the U.S., people were looking out and on the horizon, you know, you could see the lights of Washington State. And finally, the captain came over and told us, yes, indeed, it was lights from the United States. So as you can imagine, and you probably went through the same thing, everybody broke out in full-throated, you know, cheers.
Yay.
And the head flight attendant started singing God Bless America.
Oh.
And was joined by the entire airplane. It was something, it's a remembrance that you had to be there. And, you know, you never forget it. It was really something. When I got back from Vietnam, I got assigned to Fort Walters, Texas, my second tour there. And I became an instructor pilot in that TH-55 thing.
Oh, good.
So I was an instructor for 16 months down there, and that was some of the best duty I ever had. Over the course of 16 months, I had 18 students, and they were all memorable, and it was a good time.
I was going to ask you, did you, when I came back, I was an instructor pilot at Fort Rucker, and advanced training toward the, they're just getting done. So we were teaching them low-level flying and auto-rotations and all this other stuff. And I always tell people I found it to be more dangerous than Vietnam, because it's like, you know, like you're teaching driver's ed, but you're in a helicopter and, you know, going to 90 miles an hour with trees and wires and things.
I know what you mean. I had a couple of instances where I thought, you know, it was safer in Vietnam than it is here in Fort Walters, Texas. Everything is relative.
You know, what are you guys trying to do? Kill me or something?
Something like that.
I made it this far. So anyway, so you ended up as a career officer.
Yes.
Where did you go from in that part of your life?
Well, when we got back, it seems like I went to night school for 27 years after that. And I finished degree completion, you might say. We bounced around. We ended up going to Korea as a family. We ended up in Latin America. As a family, you know, in the Panama Canal area. My last assignment was 6 years in the Pentagon, which was, the Pentagon's an interesting place to be, and it's interesting to be part of the entire process, but it's no fun.
I wouldn't think so.
But it is interesting to see how the Army works, how the Army funds its programs, and how it has to exist with the other services. None of this stuff, by the way, is in the book, because the book is essentially the first 23 years of my life.
Right.
I jammed a lot of stuff into the first 23
years. You did. This is a good read. People can't see, but I'm trying to lift the book up here.
It almost looks like the Bible, doesn't it?
Well, it's got good print in it, too.
I did that for us guys over 70.
I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And it's got some really cool photos in here. And as our childhoods were in the 1950s, and so a lot of them are in black and white, you know, and I bet you have some examples too of people said, well, why didn't you take a bunch of pictures while you were in Vietnam? And you say, you know, I was busy. You know, how do I fly a helicopter and take pictures at the same time?
I know. And remember, it was long before, you know, the cell phones of today, everybody has a camera everywhere.
Yes.
And, you know, we obviously didn't have that. And you're right. How do you take it? There's two of us supposed to be concentrating real hard up here. And sometimes the crew chiefs would take pictures. And I think some of the pictures that's how they came to me. It was the fact
right.
that.
Yeah, they took better pictures than
crew chiefs took pictures. They passed them along to us.
Yeah. Plus we had the little, you know, little Kodak cameras.
The Instamatics. That's why some of those pictures that you reference in the book are all black and white. But some of those are pictures of pictures from 55 years ago. And so they come out a little bit cloudy. You know, they've been around the block a time or two.
Yeah, well, they're great pictures, and it's a great book, Frank. And I really applaud you the effort that you put into this. And it's, you know, we always say here at Veterans Radio that every veteran has a story to tell, and you know, some of them are very similar, but they're all your stories.
Yeah.
And I think the idea that you were able to get it out and get it on paper, and the book is available as an audio book, folks. So, you know, you can just go to, you know, your favorite place for books. Amazon, I know, because I just downloaded the audio book this morning because I wanted to make sure I didn't miss something when I was reading it. And it's narrated by the Frank Fox, well-known book narrator.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words.
But I really do. I encourage you. And a lot of you out there will be able to relate to the stories that are in here. You know, and as I was reading it, I was traveling all over the country. You know, you mentioned the lot in here quite a bit. Now, I was down south a little bit more, but we went to the lot one time we flew up the interior decorator for a general in Saigon to buy furniture in the lot.
Oh.
And when we came back, we had the whole cargo area was full of furniture.
A little hard
there's
to get
your American tax dollars at work.
A little hard to get your head around that war, wasn't it?
It was. It was. There were so many things that just didn't make any sense. Although, and I do agree with you, it was probably one of the most important times of my life. And I met some of the most amazing men that were friends of mine forever, you know, and unfortunately, you know, some of the side effects of that war have taken many of them away. And that just makes you, you know, getting a little angry over that. So we are coming up to the end of the program, Frank. Again, I want to thank you so much. And I look forward to talking to you again just for fun.
I will do that. You'll be hearing from me again. Thank you very much, Dale. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Hang around. I can talk when we're done. All right. I'm coming up on how much time have I got? I got 1 minute. All right. Just to remind everybody that we'll be coming back next week with another Veterans Radio. We're going to be talking to a guy who goes around and collects the stories of veterans, like many of us do. He does long versions. He sits down with the veterans and records them. It's from an organization called Veteran Archives. I think you'll find it interesting. And don't forget the Fisher House fundraiser coming up on the 5th of April. Go to fisherhousemichigan.org/events. Hopefully I will see you there. We're going to go out today again on our God Bless America. And we play this every week because I just think that it's a great song and we live in a great country. And we just got to keep going on because I think it's really important for us to remember to never give up. And it's whatever it is, this too shall pass. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry. For all of us here at Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountain to the prairie, to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, my oh, shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. The prairies to the oceans white with foam.